From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. He's best known for playing tactical officer Hikaru Sulu on Star Trek.
Oh my. Oh my, my, my.
We talked to George Takei about his work as an activist, plus the conspiracy theories of Georgia, and finally, some tips on how to debate with class from the Gentlemen of Morehouse. Tomorrow marks the third anniversary of On Second Thought, and we're celebrating with some of the best conversations in the show's history. But one of the very best conversations we can have is with you when you pick up the phone and decide to support this show and GPB. This is our fall fund drive, so take a couple minutes of your time to give at gpb.org. Actor George Takei is a man who needs very little introduction. He first came to fame as young Sulu in the original Star Trek series, but he's since become an active voice in promoting equal rights for LGBT people.
Anytime you need to say the word gay, you can simply say Takei. For example, you could safely proclaim you are a supporter of Takei marriage. If you're in a more festive mood, you can march in a Takei pride parade.
It's okay to be Takei. It's okay to be Takei.
We spoke to Takei earlier this year when the play Allegiance was showing in Atlanta movie theaters. The play is inspired by Takei's experiences in a Japanese internment camp during World War II.
I wonder how far you are now from where you thought you'd be when you were in your 20s.
Actually, in my 20s, I imagined myself being a leading man in major feature productions. I reached for the high star.
But did you ever imagine that you would be in this position as a cultural icon, as a leader, not just in LGBT rights, but also at this point for refugees and the treatment of American citizens and civil rights?
Absolutely. And on the Broadway stage with a musical that is inspired by the internment of Japanese Americans. I never dreamed of that, and I was able to achieve that with Allegiance, which is going to be screened on a very significant date, February 19th. And it was on that date, 75 years ago, that President Franklin D. Roosevelt signed an executive order numbered 9066, which ordered all Japanese Americans on the West Coast. I was a five-year-old child, but I was included in that, to be summarily rounded up with no charges, no trial, no due process, in the most unjust way, to be rounded up and imprisoned in these barbed wire prison camps simply because we happen to look like the people that bombed Pearl Harbor.
Many Americans think that could never happen today, right? But we're talking about an executive order that was upheld by the Supreme Court. Do you feel as though that kind of thing could happen? Is it possible to see history repeating itself even in 2017?
We are saying that just a few weeks after our current president, Donald Trump, signed another executive order on January 27th. Which incidentally happens to be the Holocaust Remembrance Day. He signed an executive order with a sweeping statement characterizing Muslims coming from seven Muslim-majority nations as potential terrorists. So again, the echoes of that unjust incarceration that began in 1942 is being felt in reality today.
There were many Japanese Americans who lost their property, lost their businesses when they came back.
My family, my parents, my father lost his business, our home, our freedom, and we were put in these camps and impoverished. We were imprisoned for the duration of the war, 4 years. And when the war ended, as suddenly as they rounded us up, the gates were thrown open. We were free to go.
No compensation.
At that time, we were given a one-way ticket to wherever in the United States we wanted to go to, and $25. We were supposed to start life all over again. And my brother was seven. My baby sister, who wasn't even a year old when we were imprisoned.
She was born in the,
Her whole life practically. She was 5 years old.
Her whole life. How do you come out of that, though, and not hold resentment for your country?
Well, when I became a teenager, I became a voracious reader. I read everything, particularly civics books and history books. I became fascinated with that. And I was taken by the noble ideals of our democracy. All men are created equal, endowed with an inalienable right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And I couldn't quite reconcile that with what I knew to be my childhood imprisonment. And so I had many long and sometimes heated discussions after dinner with my father. And I learned about American democracy from a man who lost everything in the middle of his life, that he had worked for. And he said to me, "I'll show you how it works." And the following Sunday afternoon, he took me downtown to the Adlai Stevenson for President campaign headquarters. And he introduced me to how our democracy has to work. People, passionate people who are dedicated to getting a good man elected president of the United States. And so I was taken by that. And I was there almost every night after school and on weekends working with them. Governor Stevenson of Illinois did not win. General Eisenhower did. But my father said, in a democracy, you never give up. You keep on keeping on.
So I wonder what differences you see. I mean, obviously, you were quite young when you were in the American internment camps. But when you compare that to what's happening now, you're obviously opposed to the travel ban that was...
Absolutely. It's that sweeping characterization of a whole group of people, you know, which is... Because we simply looked like the people that bombed Pearl Harbor. It was crazy. We were neither the enemy nor aliens. We were born in this country, raised in this country. That kind of irrationality, and the same kind of irrationality is happening now, as we're discovering when these people who were banned but with the stay are coming to this country. People who fought for this country, grandmas, are being reunited with their families. These aren't people that are dangerous.
So most politicians have pretty low approval ratings. You, on the other hand, have very high approval ratings.
Are you trying to get me to run for office?
Why have you never run for office?
Why are you going to curse me that way?
Ronald Reagan, there have been Donald Schwarzenegger, you know, Sonny Bono.
You know, Ronald Reagan, to his credit, in 1988, apologized for that imprisonment and paid a $20,000 token redress to all survivors who were alive at that point in 1988. And that token redress, $20,000, paid to all the surviving survivors at that time, totaled up to $1.6 billion. And that's the kind of penalty, consequence, that Donald Trump is talking about by this kind of thoughtless, reckless, sloppily executed executive order.
It's such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you for inviting me.
This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. You know, this show first went on the air October 20th of 2014, and that means tomorrow is our third birthday, and we are marking the occasion with some of the best conversations of the past 3 years. This was a good one. Belief and fact do not always line up. An Emory University class dives into the convoluted world of conspiracy theories and how they actually influence American politics. This is a part of our occasional series, Lessons from Left Field, in which we look into unusual classes held around the state. So joining me now is Emory instructor Felix Harcourt. Hi there, Felix.
Hi.
Also here are two students, Laura Marquez. Hi, Laura.
Hi there.
And Carolyn Conkey.
Good morning.
Good morning. It's good to have all of you here. Felix, what classifies as a conspiracy theory? How do you separate a conspiracy theory from an actual question that might be credible and put in the Washington Post?
It's an excellent question. It's one that we actually spend considerable time in the class discussing how to define what a conspiracy theory is and how to define who a conspiracy theorist is. And at its heart, a conspiracy theory is any conspiracy for which evidence cannot be shown. where that then extends out to becomes, I think the word you used before was convoluted, and yeah, that's an excellent word to use with regard to these ideas.
Well, one person most Americans recognize as a conspiracy theorist is talk radio show host Alex Jones. He's spread a number of conspiracy theories. For example, he believes 9/11 was an inside job orchestrated by the U.S. government.
When we question official stories where the system has the motive, the means, it basically stands to gain, that is patriotic thing to do. Because if you're not aware of false flags, self-inflicted wounds, staged terror attacks, then you invite the system to do this.
So, Felix, how do you then approach some of these ones that most people just sort of dismiss them out of hand? Alex Jones, for example, says he has evidence that 9/11 was an inside job. So you're raising your eyebrows, but that's what he says. So how do you approach that?
Really what the class is about is to be able to take these things, these ideas that it is easy to marginalize, it is easy to mock, because they are so far outside of our kind of understanding of the reality of the situation, and to consider them within their historical context, their social, their cultural context, to confront and dismantle them and to figure out where are these ideas coming from? Why are they being put forward? What situates them within our current society? And to what extent can we understand them as part of this long history of American conspiracism? And particularly to look at the kind of tropes and cliches that conspiracy theorists tend to use to try to put those ideas over. The idea that we tend to refer to in the class as the symbolism of evidentiary rigor, right? There's not actual evidence, but it seems as though there is evidence.
Before we get to our students here, let's actually hear some people that we spoke to on the streets of Atlanta. We asked them if there were any conspiracy theories that they believe in.
9/11, I do believe, was something they're trying to keep secret. They're not giving out the full story, which leaves a lot of people on the fence and skeptical about, was it real?
I definitely believe in Illuminati. I feel like it's something weird going on with all the powerful people.
I have concerns about whether or not the government controls the weather. The weather is like just so bipolar. One minute it's warm, one minute it's cold.
Okay, so Laura, let's start with you. Did you believe any conspiracy? Do you believe in any conspiracy theories?
No. I came into the class feeling very skeptical of conspiracy theories. I think my instinct when hearing about them is just kind of thinking that they are, you know, people who believe in them are kind of nutty or, you know, just believing in falsehoods. Yeah, so I was definitely very skeptical.
Do you believe in any conspiracy theories?
I actually do. Going into the class, I was in very much the same place, thinking conspiracy theories are just things that crazy people say. I think what I've really learned is that, well, I don't necessarily agree with how far conspiracy theories tend to take it. A lot of times there's a little bit of an element of truth. You don't make a conspiracy about a thing where everyone knows all of the facts. So there's usually some element, not what the conspiracists say there is, but there's something with what the government did that triggered this idea of conspiracism in that context.
All right. I want to play a clip referring to one of the most persistent conspiracy theories ever. This is author David Talbot, who says he believes there were two shooters in JFK's assassination, one of them tied to the CIA.
No one else had the kind of organizational power to do it and the kind of way of covering it up in the CIA.
And, of course, here's Oliver Stone. He's the filmmaker behind 1991's JFK. He also believes there were two shooters, and here he is speaking to CNN.
I resort always to the basics, like common sense, your own eyes. There is this wonderful document called the Zapruder film that shows you the time frame and shows you what the shots were doing step by step. And we estimate the people in the community, five shots, maybe six. And you show in the kill shot, Kennedy is going back and to the left very clearly. The shot has to come from the front.
So, Felix, I have to imagine you have to spend some time on the JFK assassination, right?
Certainly.
When you come from Oliver Stone, who made a whole movie claiming that they have evidence, then how do you teach your students to sort of sift through what you've already said sounds authentic and credible?
It's a question of putting something like Oliver Stone, putting somebody like Oliver Stone within their historical context and seeing where his ideas come from. And we can track the ideas that Oliver Stone puts forward back to really the immediate aftermath of the assassination. And you start to see the contemporary New Left concerns about government power, about LBJ, about the rising national security state and the war in Vietnam, really give birth to consistent conspiracist tropes. And understanding it in that way allows us to kind of dismantle current conspiracist thinking within this broader context.
That's Felix Harcourt and two of his students, Carolyn Conkey and Laura Marquet. We'll continue this conversation in just a moment. I'm Celeste Headlee. This is On Second Thought. For our third anniversary, we're bringing you some of the best conversations we've had, and this one definitely ranks among the most fun we've had. We talked with instructor Felix Harcourt and two of his students, Carolyn Conkey and Laura Marquet. Felix teaches a class at Emory that dives into the convoluted world of conspiracy theories and how they influence American politics. Laura, were there conspiracy theories that you ended up taking more seriously that you now think differently of? And is one of them the JFK assassination?
Yeah, I think the JFK assassination was very interesting because I don't think I could have imagined how many theories there actually were. I mean, and we didn't even cover all of them, but we had a one or two page sheet with just a laundry list of theories, and I couldn't have imagined. So definitely put some doubt into what I had previously believed, poke some holes into the kind of narrative that has been accepted as the official narrative.
Carolyn, are you ready to reveal which conspiracy theory you had second thoughts about?
So I actually had the same experience as Oliver Stone. We watched the Zapruder film in class, and seeing that, reading how people had analyzed, I was like, this doesn't quite add up. And obviously, I'm not a forensic scientist, so I can't actually verify that what they are saying is how it's supposed to go is actually how it's supposed to go. But just reading the story, it doesn't quite make sense to me. So it opened up to me the possibility of not necessarily one of the more out there, like there's two Lee Harvey Oswald kind of conspiracies, but the idea that what the government has told us about the Kennedy assassination isn't quite what actually happened.
So you're not all the way to Oliver Stone?
Not quite, but on the same path.
Ready. Okay. Let's hear from journalist David Aronovich. One of his missions is to debunk conspiracy theories. He wrote a book called Voodoo Histories, The Role of the Conspiracy Theory in Shaping Modern History. Here he is speaking to NPR in 2010.
The thing about dealing with conspiracy theories is you can't just assume right from the beginning that any conspiracy theory is automatically wrong because it seems to violate common sense. I mean, you're absolutely right. You have to go back to first principles and say, what is the evidence for this?
So, but one of the claims that he makes is that conspiracy theories, even when they're completely outlandish, actually have a huge impact on culture. And that sounds like something that you say in your class as well. How does that add up? For example, the conspiracy theories that we didn't land on the moon. How do things like that actually shape politics and culture?
It's a good question. In large part, especially as we move through the kind of the later 20th century and especially post-Watergate, what conspiracy theories really do is help fuel growing distrust of the government as a body. And you see this almost feedback loop created where real conspiracies are revealed, right? The CIA did engage in something like MKUltra. Nixon was behind the break-in at the Watergate Hotel.
There actually was a Soviet spy in Congress during the whole Red Scare, for example. That turned out to be true.
And as these ideas come out, as they're released, they give greater fuel to the idea that there are even bigger secrets hiding. And so you see this growing snowball of distrust. And that distrust gets almost weaponized politically. It's a very, very useful tool to galvanize voters.
So then let's hear about a very recent conspiracy theory. This is President Trump tweeted that he'd been wiretapped by former President Obama. Federal investigators, I want to emphasize, no one has found any evidence of this at all. But Trump revealed that he got this from a Fox News pundit.
We said nothing. All we did was quote a certain very talented legal mind who was the one responsible for saying that on television. I didn't make an opinion on it. That was a statement made by a very talented lawyer on Fox. And so you shouldn't be talking to me. You should be talking to Fox.
We have a tweet from Melanie Harper who says, I can believe in business conspiracies like nicotine spiking easier than government conspiracies. Greed is a permanent motive. Let's hear about another relatively recent conspiracy theory, again involving Donald Trump. He joined the birther movement, which he questioned whether President Obama was born in the U.S. He told NBC News in 2011 that he just wanted to see the birth certificate.
If he doesn't, it's one of the greatest scams in the history of politics and in the history, period. Yeah. You are not allowed to be a president if you're not born in this country. He may not have been born in this country. And I'll tell you what, 3 weeks ago, I thought he was born in this country. Right now, I have some real doubts.
There is no doubt. Again, let me just emphasize that is not true. President Obama was born in the United States. But Carolyn, if you have more, if you give more credibility to some conspiracy theories than you did to others, how do you go about doing that? If you see a news headline come up, what process do you go through to judge its truthiness?
I think a lot of it goes back to just evaluating the evidence kind of for yourself. I think, especially if we're looking at how President Trump tweets out some of these conspiracies, he just asserts it without any of the evidence actually being there. And it's really hard to evaluate whether or not there's any truthiness to that statement without looking at the evidence yourself. And I think that was a lot of what kind of changed my beliefs in this class, was looking not just at what the conspiracists said, but what actually happened and the facts that were behind that. And I think when you look into what they claim supports your evidence, you can really see whether or not they're making some kind of crazy leap or there is some kernel of truth that you can keep investigating more.
So Felix, most of the people listening are never going to take your class, but what advice would you give people sifting through their Twitter and Facebook feed on how to inoculate themselves against conspiracy theories?
I think Laura made a good point in bringing up footnotes, right? Conspiracy theorists love footnotes. They love the symbolism of evidence. And I would say always click through the evidence to see what it is that they're actually citing in support of their ideas, to see whether or not it does in fact support that case.
Right, like the long debunked study that supports the anti-vaccine movement, which has been debunked over and over and over again. They may be citing that.
Right.
That's Felix Harcourt and two of his students, Carolyn Conkey and Laura Marquet. Is there a conspiracy theory that you believe? Tell us what it is. Reach us on Twitter at OST Talk. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. On Second Thought is celebrating its third anniversary, and that gives us an excuse to listen back to some of the best conversations we've had. This one is definitely included. Last year, the U.S. University's Debating Championship was held at Morehouse College. Morehouse was the first historically black college to host the tournament. Debate in this context is more than an argument. It's a formal contest with rules. And we brought in some experts to walk us through those rules. Ken Newby is the director of the forensics program at Morehouse College, and he brought two members of the debate team with him. Davon Boyd is the team captain and a junior at Morehouse, and Keith Marier is a sophomore and Phi Kappa Delta national champion of British parliamentary debate. Morehouse is the first HBCU to host this event. What kind of conversations have you guys had about how to play a good host?
Well, we've all worked really hard, and I think Coach has done a fantastic job of getting us all on the same page in terms of what we have to do to make sure that the tournament is successful. And I think we also understand the significance that comes from being an HBCU, participating in the format in the very first place where a lot of people of color aren't involved in, but also the significance that comes with hosting a tournament of this magnitude. So I think we're certainly up for the challenge.
All right. We want to give our listeners a taste of what this may be like if they were at this weekend events. So Keith and Devon will debate the merits of cake versus pie, a long-standing argument.
One of those deep and brilliant
yes,
debates.
It is. So we'll give you each first a minute to present your case, and then you can have 30 seconds rebuttal time. And Devon, you start. You have 1 minute.
1 minute. All right, here we go. So two arguments for why cake is better than pie. The first is that it encapsulates a greater culinary experience. So you have more richness, more diversity that comes with moisture, texture, from German chocolate cake to ice cream cake. So we're talking about cake batter, baking, frosting, as compared to pies that are a bit more myopic and monolithic. You can have apple, blueberry, sweet potato. There is some variance, but there certainly isn't that diversity that you get from dealing with cakes and the making process. And secondly, and most importantly, it is an important staple in our human experience. You have cakes at birthdays, weddings, graduations. Pies don't get this type of appeal to individuals, in part because cake is very important to what individuals believe really encapsulates the beauty of their celebration. So it's inextricable. You don't imagine a birthday without a birthday cake. You don't imagine a wedding without a wedding cake. And it's indelible. There's a certain permanence. You remember what it means to cut a slice of that cake together, the symbolism with it.
That was 1 minute. Exactly. Keith, you have a minute to make your case for pie.
Ah, man, it's always so hard following up Dave Vaughn, our captain. But I like to contend against the idea that pie is monolithic. I say that pie actually isn't monolithic, especially when we look at the historical etymology of pie. It started off in the Greek and Roman tradition as actually being one in which they could save the meats or save the fillings. So it's not necessarily a monolithic. It's actually more diverse. And that is the first argument that I actually have. You have, like, chicken pot pie. You have apple pie. Then you have idioms such as it's as American as apple pie. So in looking at that, I say it actually has a rich diversity on what those things are. But my second argument is that prototypical pies are circular, and that's very symbolic of the nature of the American history and how we want to encapsulate the human purview. That's to say, when we have circular ideas on, like, a homogeneous idea of what it means to have a pie versus the unequal distribution of cakes and how we enjoy cakes and the icing of that cake, we would much rather prefer a pie and how we would cut a pie and distribute that pie.
And time.
Equally.
Let me go to you, Ken. What did we just hear?
I think you just heard a very intellectual exchange about cake versus pie. You know, me personally, I think who won the debate comes down to what you value the most. If you value the events that are associated with the desserts, I think you go with Davon for
cake.
Yeah, I think you go with Davon for cake. But if you're really thinking about the diversity of taste, I think you got to go with pie. I mean, no one wants to eat a chicken cake, so I think Keith's chicken pot pie diversity arguments are pretty persuasive.
Okay, so were they following the techniques that you've taught them? I mean, can you even use those classical British parliamentary techniques in what we heard, an argument of food?
They most certainly were, because if you follow the structure of their arguments, they made bold claims, but they just didn't leave those claims as naked assertions. They backed them up with what we call warrants and evidence.
Keith, you probably have noticed the breakdown in a lot of conversations, and people say that there's just some things we can't talk about civilly anymore. And I wonder what you feel about that when you get into especially political topics, abortion or access to healthcare, things like that. Are there things that just can't be discussed civilly?
Well, no, I don't think so. And I think my experience on the debate team has taught me that or made me appreciate that. That's to say, I don't necessarily believe all the things that me, Dave Vaughn, or the rest of the team has to debate, but it allows me to critically engage these ideas and understand the perspectives that people come from. So when I have to advocate, let's say, for things that I don't necessarily believe in, by my ability or by being forced to articulate that purview, I now understand what other individuals are thinking, what they're believing, and what they actually want to be politically advanced.
Ken, let me go back to what Devon was talking about earlier in terms of being the first HBCU to host this event. What is the historical precedent that you're setting, especially, you know, when people think about debating, especially at a black college, they think about the movie The Great Debaters, right? How is the history here making it more significant?
Sure. And, you know, Morehouse, we have a 110-year history of debating. It's really a tradition of the college. We first started our debate team as sort of a three-way triangular debate between other HBCUs. And back in that time, 1906, 1907, 08, HBCUs weren't even allowed to debate majority institutions.
That's Ken Newby, director of the forensics program at Morehouse College, and two members of the debate team, Davon Boyd and Keith Marier.